Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
So now, ladies and gentlemen, it is start time. Are you ready for start time?
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we are talking with music journalist Josh Terry about accessibility issues in live music. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. But first, we're happy to welcome Tune Yards back to the show.
That is a little bit of Tune Yards performing Business on Sound Opinions way back in 2011. Back then, their breakthrough album, Who Kill, was making major waves in the music world. And since, they've released 3 studio albums and a movie score. Their latest recording, Sketchy, is one of my favorite records that I've heard this year.
And we would love to welcome back Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards to Sound Opinions. Welcome, Merrill.
I'm so happy to be here. 10 years
it
later,
was, it seems like only yesterday, 2011, Who Kill had just come out, second album, and we had you on the show, and it was such a pleasure. And we've reviewed several albums since, following your career. But this new record, Sketchy, had a little bit longer gestation than usual for you. You had taken a couple of years to put this one together. So tell us about how Sketchy came together.
Mm. I will say, I did listen to your review of Sketchy. I was very scared too, but then I thought, I trust these guys like no others.
Oh God. Merrill, you should have learned by now never to read.
I never do, but
trust a critic.
I usually never do, but thank you. It actually made me teary because I miss your all's voices. Nate and I used to tour together alone in his Honda Fit, and we used to listen to Sound Opinions quite a bit. So anyway, your voices brought it all back to me. It was actually all recorded before the pandemic. The only stuff that happened after March of 2020 was Matt Nelson's saxophone on Hold Yourself and a couple others, and then the mixing. So a lot of the songs feel relevant to post-pandemic life, but it was all from just what was brewing. So at the time, you know, we would walk or bike to our studio, which is a rehearsal studio where we have packed a lot of recording equipment in downtown Oakland. And I would set a timer, do vocal warm-ups, set another timer to try to get some ideas down. And then Nate would come in a little later. We'd overlap and work on some stuff. Then I'd leave and go to the YMCA and go for a swim.
That sounds like a nice day.
Right?
That makes sense. It sounds very sane.
Life was good.
We should note that the Nate you speak of, your longtime musical collaborator and life partner, Nate Brenner.
Yeah.
So you guys would have been in each other's bubble anyway.
Exactly. This was a natural progression, I think, from the last album. But it was, I did want to move, you know? I wanted to move my body through difficult work and through what clearly, you know, even before the pandemic again, we were facing a potential pandemic. Plenty of people knew that the pandemic was probable. We were facing what we were facing with climate change. We were facing what we've been seeing with the uprising after George Floyd's murder. So like we were facing all that before. So I think what really felt needed for me just in my body was to be able to move through hard stuff.
I interviewed you for the Chicago Tribune back when I Can Feel You Creep Into My Private Life came out.
That's right.
And I could sense you were a troubled person after that album came out, in terms of there was big questions, and it was almost like you were interrogating yourself on that record.
Yeah.
Not almost, you were.
I was, yeah.
Oh, the relaxation I feel most everywhere, except the places I don't go. Except the places I don't go. No, don't trust me.
You were troubled by it. You were wondering if you'd made the record that anybody else is going to appreciate. Although I thought it had elements of dance music in it, but it seemed like you sort of doubled down on the dance. I'm going to make it groovy and
body
freeing,
body moving,
as opposed to so. Because I think the one I wrote this, it was one of the last lines in the review I wrote. She can't switch off her brain. You know, and it's like here's the brain is just working over. You can just feel the fumes coming out. You know. So how did you do that? How did you switch off your brain, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Good question. How did... Swimming.
Swimming, yeah.
I mean, I think a part of it is realizing that while I'm in a, you know, a feedback loop with myself, because, you know, these things are troubling. It should trouble me to make money off of racism, right? Like the last record was about interrogating myself as a white person and exploring whiteness and other things, but... You know, I should ask myself questions, as I think all white people who make money on racism should ask themselves.
Yeah.
What is this? What am I doing? And where is it healing and where is it harmful? But the thing is, if I get into a feedback loop, I'm not, you know, first of all, you know, people are storming the Capitol and people are forming, you know, whiteness groups that are not anti-racist whiteness groups, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
If I'm so self-centered and worried about being perfect, which I think it can be an aspect of white culture, right? Like I got to get it perfectly right before I say anything so no one can critique me at all. And I just thought, I saw very clearly that I was stuck in that. So, you know, it is the thing about music, as you both know well, is that it's a mess. It's a mess of influences, collaborations. You don't, you know, no musician, if we're just playing from our guts, we, you know, hopefully aren't going, oh, well, this lick comes from this person that I learned it, or this record that I used to li-. We're not doing that. We're filtering what we've learned and listened to through ourselves as musicians. And to try to make some kind of order and sense and categorization out of everything that I am as a musician, you know, breaking it down is just like taking the life out of it. And I think on the last record, I'm proud of it in a lot of ways, but I do think I sucked a lot of the life out of it.
You seemed tense. You seemed worrying about how can I be a good ally? Mm-hmm. What are my responsibilities as a white person? So Meryl, let me just ask you an irreverent question. How much of this comes from living within spitting distance of Berkeley and San Francisco? Any conscious white person today should be asking themselves, how can I be an ally?
Yep.
I don't want a gold star for being an ally. I'm a sentient human being. Right. But, you know, I mean, you know what I'm talking about. That San Francisco, you know, uber white guilt thing.
Right. And also the hypocrisy of it. Like, for instance, you can, you know, live in Berkeley and nobody's given back the land where the Shell Mountains are. You know, indigenous people of this area for... probably, I would assume, decades, if not hundreds of years, have been saying, please give us the sacred land back. And, you know, I don't live in Berkeley. I'm plenty hypocritical myself over here in East Oakland.
Oh, somewhere there's a place I'll find my rhyme. Am I in the nowhere that is mine?
But what are we doing? Like, are we really so busy saying and putting posters out on our lawns how good we are? And meanwhile, not paying, you know, like not giving something up. And I think white people need we need to start feeling some pleasure around this work so that we'll be inclined to give up some stuff. Because yeah. it's hard. We live in a culture of scarcity, and everybody's afraid to give up what they have, but we're going to need to start too, I think.
Before we go any further, Meryl, you used the phrase profiting from racism. You are not the Rolling Stones with the jet playing to 100,000 people with 100,000 SUVs.
The carbon
pulling
footprint
up.
Is not quite as large.
You're not on a label that has exploited everyone from Robert Johnson to the present. What are you talking about, profiting from racism?
We made an album based off of work that I did starting in a Buddhist center here in Oakland, East Bay Meditation Center, work that was around whiteness, that was around the idea of white supremacy living within us as white people and doing work to dismantle that, right? So the creative work that came out of months and months and months of that work, it then becomes our income. Our royalties come from that record. You know, we may not be the Stones. Don't get me started about the Stones, but...
Speaking of profiting from racism...
Which I guess is different than profiting from white privilege. So you could say the Stones and other bands who are taking blues and, you know, bringing them to white audiences that had more money, you know, that's a different thing. I'm talking about writing about and creating around the topic of racism and then making money from it. I should at least question what that is. And for us, that has meant redistributing the money that comes in, you know, and I don't talk about that publicly so much, but
I will disagree with you, Meryl. I think you could flip it and not say profiting from racism. Why don't you say profiting from activism? You know, you have been fighting the racism through your personal example of activism and talking in all your interviews about these things and, you know, giving people a model to aspire to. Wow, she's so cool and creative and she talks about these things and she does the work.
Which is why I'm still doing it, right? I think that it outweighed all these questions about, quote unquote, profiting from racism. And again, we get to choose what happens with our money after the fact. But it feels so important. I felt like the culture is so bereft of white people talking about the experience of whiteness, because we talk a lot about racism and how it's bad, but we don't talk a lot about whiteness and what the experience of race as a white person is. And I really, I really think that that was clearly important for me to put out into the world.
And I think you're right. I think that because the rest of the world isn't Oakland, the thinking, the culture that's incubating there all the time. And I think that has become really central to the discussion, like, you know, in the last year. When did that record come out? Like 3 years ago, you know? I think that was a fresh idea back then for a lot of people who heard the record for the first time. And now it's very much a part of the zeitgeist in terms of how we're processing what's happening before our very eyes. Top down, doesn't cut it. Will I love you? Can I love you? Top
down, doesn't cut it. Can I love you at all? After a quick break, we'll be back with more from Toon Yards, including how Meryl got involved with Boots Riley's film, Sorry to Bother You, and making music with her in-laws. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, lemonade, shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. And we're back. And we are talking with Merrill Garbus of Toon Yards.
I wanted to ask you about that track, Hold Yourself, because I think that's a key track for this record. We all have trouble being brave enough to turn the page. There's a lot of finger pointing at the older generation. They started all this. They made this huge mess, and now we have to live in it. And it's kind of like you're turning it back on yourself and saying, okay, now we got to own up to, we got to fix this.
Yeah.
And we can't make the same mistake. I mean, so was there a moment in particular that led to that self-reckoning?
A lot of moments. Yeah. I think that song kind of broke me. Like, I feel, from the second I played those chords on the Yamaha DX7, vintage 80s Yamaha DX7.
Nice.
There's something that, again, music can do that words and logic can't. Parents are children. Parents are children. It was like a sound that said all of those things. Like, here's, you know, that it's not about blaming my parents. I don't blame my parents. I see exactly how it went down. I see exactly that they did their best. I see where they came from. I see where I come from, you know? And I just felt like my heart broke, that it's heartbreaking to see how we keep perpetuating the things that are literally our demise, you know? And I've been really trying to think about and say, on some of the album, like, who is we? When I really think, I've been thinking about, like, do I really mean we? Who am I including in we? But I really do think we do all have doubt. And we, yeah, you know, and that we do all reckon with change and being able to change. Sure, there's finger pointing and rage, as I say, but there's also a real attempt to forgive and find forgiveness, because I can see that I will need that forgiveness for myself. I already need that forgiveness for myself.
Well, and the rage you're talking about is directed towards people who are not caring about the fact that even if we survive the pandemic, even if we come to some sort of peace in the Black Lives Matter and Me Too upheavals of the moment, then all we have to do is worry about the fact that the planet's only going to last another 20 years, maybe,
no
before,
problem.
You know.
No problem. No problem, guys. We got it.
So you see climate change as a racial threat, as a, you know, because obviously the poor people are going to, you know, as has been said many times by commentators smarter than me, it's the poorer nations and the poorer neighborhoods and the poorer cities that are going to be devastated. It's all kind of one big ball of problem we have to attack.
Yeah.
And what I love is that while you're raging against it throughout Sketchy, you're also saying, but let's at least dance together.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. And think about the power of dance. And think about, I mean, for instance, I have had a lot of time and study and experience with Haitian dance. Think about the way that Haitian dance was inextricably linked to the revolution. I mean, dance and music and ritual. And again, as a white person, I think that I have to have done a little bit of work going back to, where did my ritual go? You know, I come from Eastern European Jews, and Appalachian Presbyterians who somewhere came from, I didn't even know what Scotch Irish was. My family always said, you know, Scotch Irish. I didn't know that that meant that it was Scottish people who were compelled to leave Scotland to go settle Northern Ireland. I didn't know that.
Well, you had two choices. You could go serve in Napoleon's army, fighting Napoleon's army and be blown apart by the cannons,
right.
Or you could get the hell out of Ireland or Scotland.
That's the thing. Right. Great. Yeah. And to know, okay, well, that's in my genealogy. And, you know, we don't talk about that drama a lot.
Neither privileged, neither the Appalachian side of the family nor the Jewish.
Right. And how do I reckon with that history to, sure, forgive my ancestors, but then also consider how they learned to survive? And, you know, I was lucky that I grew up with folky parents, and my mom taught at a camp, a folk music camp called Pinewoods, for my whole life. And so I got to see folk music from, like, my mom played for English country dances, you know, I learned the Abbots Bromley, you know, a ritual dance from England. From way back when. So I can at least touch into the ways that dance and music have propelled, you know, culture, propelled people's lives for forever.
How do you think the music world's going to change when we emerge from this pandemic? There's some rays of light now. Mm-hmm. How much of the infrastructure is going to be left that made your career? Mm. Do you think we're going to emerge with this stuff intact?
That's a really good question. The ecosystem of the smaller clubs, I think, is what always gets forgotten. And that's certainly where, you know, I come from, the open mics and the, you know, any, you know, the DIY venues, the, you know, friends putting together house shows. So, you know, as with so much in the music industry, I think there's, it's, and the economy in general, it's super top heavy, right? So what I worry about is the steps that bands will use to climb up to being able to play some of these, as they say, quote unquote, legitimate venues, as in, as in
venues with a bathroom.
Okay, sure. Bathroom. Wow. Yeah. Luxury. Yeah. Exactly. Venues with maybe a liquor license, or, you know, and promoters who promote shows. So I don't know. I think in a lot of ways, of course, we'll be one of the lucky bands that can already draw crowds, so that, you know, I would assume some of the larger venues will survive, having been able to get the loans from the government and, you know, things to help small businesses survive. But we'll see. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, I think music survives. So I know that the people will put on shows. The people need music.
Yeah. You're talking about shows, and I'm going, people want to get out there and mm-hmm. dance. You know, this is the body music. We miss that.
Really?
You know, right now people can dance in their living rooms, you know, with their loved ones, but that's about it. I mean, the joy of being in a space together and having fun, dancing to some great music. And it's interesting, you worked with Boots Riley of The Coup. You and Boots are kind of, you know, cut from the same cloth, very political, but at the same time, this joyous aspect to the music, undergirding it. And you worked with Boots on that amazing movie, Sorry to Bother You, the soundtrack. How did that come about, and how did that influence, if at all, what you're doing now?
Oh, I'm sure it did. I mean, Boots, I think we met at a show at the Fox Theater in Oakland. The Coup was opening for Erykah Badu, I think, New Year's Eve one year. I think that's where we met. But he just knew of Toon Yards and approached me. He was like, this screenplay is, you know, it's gonna get made. And I was like, I read it and I was like, this is too cool for school. This is like too cool for the movie industry. There's no way this is getting made, but sure, I'll do some, you know, I'll make some sound. So I started just with some demos, and then, you know, he got funding and it got made. So Nate and I, you know, I pulled Nate in to help me compose hours worth of music. We worked on it probably I think about 4 years in the end. So it was the whole thing. And, you know, just having an artist like Boots, first of all, uncompromising artists like Boots Riley, really clear about his vision, was really inspiring to be around, of course. But, you know, the other thing is that he just has this really clear analysis, as I guess you would say, you know, the Marxian, like, it's about labor getting together and going and withholding labor is the only way that people actually have power. It's amazing to see mm-hmm. someone with like an extremely clear political view make art that doesn't feel preachy in that way. At least to me, it doesn't feel preachy. I think it's really hard to do. It's nutso. It's all over the place. It's unexpected. It's bizarre at times. I would like to think that Tunyard's like people have trouble categorizing it sometimes. And that's how I feel about what he does. You just never know what's coming. And I would say that a lot of it, the freedom of experimenting that Date and I had with something outside of Tunyard's was so useful. You know, I had been doing this classical singing and the thinking about not instead of hooks, thinking about themes, you know, using a lot of instrumentation that we hadn't before, getting more into sequences and filters, using, you know, filters on vocals and things. There was a lot of tools that we then brought into Sketchy.
So it expanded the horizon. Would you like to do more of that kind of soundtrack stuff?
Yes, and we are. We're working with Boots again, so hopefully that will.
Oh,
yeah.
Excellent.
Hopefully that'll turn into stuff. But we'll see what happens to it. But we did another film score shortly after Sorry to Bother You that hopefully will come out someday.
Well, Boots just doesn't take no for an answer. If he's making another movie, it'll get made. Right?
I guess so. Yeah, and we don't say no to Boots. We're like, there's clearly
right. You know, Meryl, you were kind enough to say you listened often to Sound Opinions, and we appreciate that. So, you know, our ethos is everyone's a critic.
Yes.
All right? So I'm going to put you on the spot and make you be a critic. Alex and I, one of our producers, keep hearing from your father-in-law, who would like us to review his album. In fact, he's suggesting a feature. You know, I think it would be interesting to have, like, relatives of famous musicians, and then you talk to them, and you could talk to me. All right, so what do you think of Nate's dad's
of
record?
Craig Brenner's record. Oh, wow. Well.
So I'm getting him on Sound Opinions. Oh, my. You know,
right. He requested this. Okay, Craig, here I go. Craig Brenner is an incredible musician. I mean, first of all, Nate grew up around him, and look what that turned out. You know, that turned out pretty well.
Yeah, worked out okay.
But this album in particular is, I think it's beautiful. And I will say, I do make an appearance on it. So this is probably a conflict of interest here.
Spring, oh, spring is near.
But, you know, I can't be partial. I love Craig and I love the music that he makes. And I think that, you know, the fact that he has devoted his life to boogie woogie piano. I mean, he's devoted his life to playing that
cool.
specific tradition, started a boogie woogie music festival in Bloomington, Indiana, which has only grown.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
And brought incredible musicians from really around the world, but, you know, real like heavy hitting old timers from New Orleans. And I just think he's done incredible things with his music life. And that's after he had a life working for the city of Bloomington and doing really incredible work, including, you know, racial justice work there in Bloomington. So he's a hero of mine.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well wow. I think we got informed here very well.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure, Meryl, you wouldn't sell us out, even for your own father-in-law. So I think, you know.
No.
We take your word for it.
This is the burden of the critic, Meryl, is that sometimes you have the nicest people in the world. I always tell my students, it's like you have to be the one to say the baby is ugly.
Totally.
You go to Thanksgiving dinner, and you're meeting your cousin's kid for the first time. You can't say, that is an ugly baby. You know, but the critic has to have that. If we hated your new record, as fond as we are of talking to you, we would have had to say, sorry, it did not move me emotionally.
Right.
It didn't say anything to me.
Because then if you don't, I don't trust a word you say. Right.
And
it's actually very rare. It's only the best of friends that will tell you, hey, your hair looks awful right now.
You got a booger on your nose.
Too much niceness in the world, I would say. And this is coming from a very nice girl, but like there's too much niceness in the world.
I can tell already you're in a much better place than you were after the last record. Not that you made a bad record. It was a great record, but it troubled you. you seem to be in a better space right now, and this music seems to be part of that. Is this kind of a turning point, do you think, or is this is there a new direction being paved here for you? How do you see the next year and year two playing out in terms of the kind of music you want to make and how you want to make it?
That's a good question. You know, I never know. The reason I like live performance so much is because I never know what's coming out. I mean, we rehearse and rehearse and rehearse, and sure, there, you know, I do the same moves with my feet and I train my voice, but in the moment, it's whatever spirit is flooding my system that comes out. And the reason this album feels so good to me, because I'm proud of it too, the reason it feels so good to me is that I think we were in the moment and just listened to what was happening, and we went with what was the most alive. And that's what I just want to keep doing. So we always say, all killer, no filler. We never want to put stuff out. There's so much music out there. I don't want to put anything out that feels like, oh, I have to do this because this is my job. I want to put stuff out that comes from that place of deep feeling and deep living. So I don't know. I really can't answer that question. I will say that I do feel, yeah, I feel more mellow about, you know, about life. 42, that's a good age to mellow out, right? Mm-hmm, to be a sure. little, that I'm not the very worst person in the world. I think I can actually finally say that with, you know, took me a while.
You know, after 4 years of, it'd be really hard to be the very worst person right. in the world.
There you
anymore.
Go. Well, there's one silver lining to that cloud.
We have been talking with Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards. Meryl, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you for coming on.
Love you guys so much. It's so good to do this again, and be well in this time.
Well, we hope to you have too. You. Maybe
hope
you and Nate
you
can come perform, and we can do a real show.
I would love that
with
so
listeners
much.
There.
Yeah, that would
let
be
it
awesome.
Be so.
She said, change yourself to change the world.
What do you think of this phase of Tune Yards' career? Do you think that dance music can go hand in hand with advocating meaningful cultural change? Let us know in our Facebook group or leave a voice message on our website. Speaking of voice messages, let's hear from some listeners right now.
Hey, this is Jeff up in Portland. I'd love to hear as a subject for a future episode, comeback kids, bands that have faltered, had a bad album or two, and then come back strong.
Hey guys, it's Bernsey in Canton, Ohio. I just listened to your backup vocals episode, which was great. I have always loved Emmylou Harris's backup work, especially on the Bob Dylan Desire album. But my all-time favorite backup has to be Led Zeppelin's Battle of Evermore with Sandy Denny.
At last the sun is shining, the clouds are blue, oh why? With flames from the dragon of darkness, the sunlight climbs his eye.
And I get goosebumps just saying that because she made that song great. Man, I wish we still had her. Anyway, love your work and peace.
This is Mark Dolce calling from Vernon Hills, Illinois. I have two entries for best backing vocals. The first is The Great Curve by Talking Heads off their album Remain in Light. One of the best Talking Heads songs in their catalog. And my second choice is Spirit by Earth, Wind & Fire off the album by the same title, released in 1976.
We must make
features Philip Bailey's stratospheric vocals and a gospel chorus in the background. Thanks a lot. It was a great show. I enjoyed it. Talk to you soon.
Hi, this is Bill Nelson from Geneva, Illinois, and I'm just calling about the background vocals. There is no cooler the background vocals of Get Ready by Rare Earth. What trailer? The coolest song. Come on.
This is Kim Zuckert calling from Los Angeles, California. A couple weeks ago, you did a show about backup singers, and you and Rachel Brodsky discussed the song The Longest Time by Billy Joel, and how Billy Joel loved doo-wop, and so did Lou Reed and Paul Simon, and wouldn't it have been great if they'd have done doo-wop together, but they couldn't have because their egos would have been too big for them to be in the same room. But guys, it happened, and I was there. In December of 1987, at Madison Square Garden, Paul Simon had a benefit concert for Big Blue, which was a medical van for children in New York City. And one of the performers was Dion. And as his Belmonts were Bruce Springsteen, Ruben Blades, James Taylor, Paul Simon, Lou Reed, and Billy Joel. And it was one of the greatest things I've ever seen in my life.
Each time we have a quarrel, it almost breaks my heart. Cause I'm so afraid we will have to part. Why must I be a teenager in love? One day I feel so happy, next day I feel so sad.
So there you go. There in fact was a time when Billy Joel, Lou Reed, and Paul Simon sang doo-wop together, and their egos weren't too big. Love the show. Bye-bye.
No more messages.
Thanks again to our listeners who left messages for us. To share your opinion and have a chance to be featured on our show, leave us a voice message at our website, soundopinions.org. Next, we talk with music journalist Josh Terry about the topic of accessibility and music venues on Sound Opinions.
Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
We're back. This week, we're talking with music journalist Josh Terry about his recent Vice article on how live music should be more accessible for disabled fans and what venues can do to improve those fans' experiences. Josh, welcome to Sound Opinions.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
This is an interesting piece because this is an ongoing issue. But the sense I get from your piece is that if it was a tough issue before for the disabled, access to concerts, you know, understanding what they're getting into before a show, as you can imagine, would be a central question for any person who's facing these difficulties, is going to be exacerbated when live music comes back, whenever it does come back. What sort of prompted you to delve into this?
In the past, I'd say 14 months, my beat has sort of shifted, you know, not having concerts. Normally, I would be writing about cool bands I really like, and I still do that, but definitely not as much now that there are no shows. So I've been focusing mainly on the plight of venues and people who have been out of work in the music industry and just sort of how the pandemic made life harder for everybody who works in music. Talking to people, it's been really great to hear the hope for the future, the hope that, like, once we can safely return to live music, that, you know, venues can come back better than they were. And talking to just people from different walks of life across the music industry, I realize that there are so many different avenues that can happen. And one of them, which is I think one of the most underreported things in the music press, is accessibility. And it's been something that I have been thinking about, especially over the past 14 months, but the more I talk to people, especially disability activists who work in music, it's something that has been on my radar. And, you know, I'm just the guy who wrote the article. The people I interviewed for the piece have been doing this work and advocating for accessibility in live music for years. One person I talked to, her name is Cassie Wilson, and she started a website called Half Access, which is a nonprofit organization which promotes accessibility in live music, but it's also a submission-based website where people can review venues based on accessibility. And it's funny because, like, when I found out about this website, I mean, it was a few years ago, I was like, all right, well, shouldn't this already be on the website for these venues? And, you know, you do a test, go on any local venue. They're going to say that they're accessible, but they're not going to say what that means.
Right, right.
And they're not going to give, like, a detailed description of what that means for someone with a disability who goes to the show.
You know, try to get into a United Center show or a big stadium show with tickets sold through Live Nation, and who do you talk to about wheelchair access, about anything? You know, in some ways, I mean, look, you know, the smaller clubs, beloved by Greg and me, don't have that info either, but you know who to call, and they will get on the phone and say, yeah, you don't know, we only use it usually at Metro for hauling gear to the top fourth floor theater, which we don't use that much. But yeah, we've got an elevator for you. At least you can talk to somebody. Who do you talk to at a Ticketmaster Live Nation United Center show?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the arenas are actually, like, relatively accessible when you look at the broad, like, spectrum of the types of venues, you know.
Right.
Because of the Americans with Disabilities Act, you know, arenas kind of have to have accessible seating, you know,
but they don't advertise it.
They don't advertise it, but, you know, compared to, say, like, historic venues that aren't built to be accessible, and compared to, say, like, general admission shows where there's no seats at all, it can be a little more tricky to, like, navigate. And when we mean by, like, well, how is the venue accessible, it's not just, like, whether or not someone can see the show. It's like, are the bathrooms accessible? Are the entrance is accessible? Is the merch table accessible? You know, just like certain venues, whether it's, you know, it's always through ignorance and not necessarily knowing, you know, they check off one box and they're like, all right, we're good. You know, when there's actually so much more and it's not just a one size fits all solution.
Well, you make the point for those who are visually and hearing challenged that in some ways this pandemic enforced shutdown with streaming being the only alternative has been a boon. You know, a show that they could not have attended because it's just impossible at 150 general admission capacity venue, they can now stream. And yeah. to see that going away is causing ability rights activists to say, wait a minute, you know, some semblance of this to continue for the part of the audience that has been excluded would be nice.
Yeah, absolutely. And every person I talked to for this piece has said the exact same thing. You know, mm-hmm. live streams have been something that people have been advocating for years, even before the pandemic. And, you know, and this was also one of the reasons why I wrote this piece now is because, you know, as we all know, tours are saying they're coming back, you know, in the fall. And every major tour announcement I saw and every major tour announcement the people I talked to saw, there wasn't any sort of note about whether or not the shows would be available to live stream. And, you know, that's upsetting because it's, you know, live streams for people who don't really think about disability issues. You know, live streams are like, I have to like log onto a computer and watch a show. It's not just that. It's a tool to bring people into the community who have otherwise been excluded or unable to join it fully. You know, every person I talked to just said like how great these live streams have been over the past 14 months. And, you know, I don't think they're going to go away entirely. Live Nation recently announced that they're equipping some of their venues with the technology to be able to live stream every show, which is really optimistic and great. And I hope venues can like take a cue from that and like understand ways that they can make their venues, whether or not it's from like a tech accessibility like standpoint by making live shows available to stream, or if it's from making costly but necessary adjustments to their facilities so that they can be more accessible.
It's almost like you need some kind of legislation that says, well, if you can't offer proper access to disabled people, then you should be able to live stream the show at your venue as a compensation.
I would definitely support that legislation. I think it's the Americans with Disabilities Act is only 30 years old, and you know it's gotten, you know, disability issues have gotten improved ever since that, but it's only been 30 years, and there's still been so many more issues that have been popping up, and ways that, you know, live music as a whole can make things more inclusive and more accessible.
Right.
Well, 30 years, and you still have how many L platforms in Chicago that are
right.
not mm. accessible as they're supposed yeah. to be according to the law?
Right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's, you know, for a lot of these venues, which are in, like, historic buildings, there's sort of a clause that they can say that, like, you know, the accessibility requirements aren't really within reason. And, you know, it's going to be a different sort of story for each and every venue. No venue is exactly alike and that's a great thing, but at the same time, you know, it presents challenges for how these venue owners and how their community can, like, talk with them and, like, how they can make their venues better.
Yeah, infrastructure costs money.
Well, that's why this was an eye-opening piece, Josh. I mean, I think those of us who love live music, you know, nothing is going to beat the experience of being in the room with the artist, feeling the bass drum in your chest. What if you can't have that experience? I think 99.9% of us are, if I never see another live stream in my life, I'm going to be happy, right? I am yeah. done with pandemic quarantine computer as bad simulacrum of concert. What if you can't get to the concert? And that's the thing. I mean, you know, so many of these smaller venues, look, it's existential. They need to have 149 people in a 150 capacity room to yeah. make their nut for the night, right? Yeah. And then so how then, if you just put it all online for everyone, people are lazy, they don't want to put pants on, they're going to stream, right? So how do you equitably, for the economics of it, nobody's saying give anybody anything for free, but how do you sell tickets like that and make it work? You must have been thinking about this, and the many interviews you did must have dealt with it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I have an optimism for when it's safe to return to live music that there's going to be such a demand that venues probably won't have to worry about whether or not they're going to sell out shows, you know. Mm-hmm. I feel like people have been raring to go, and when it's safe, I can't wait to be at a show at Metro or Sleeping Village or Empty Bottle or any one of those great places I went to multiple times a week over
yeah,
a year
right.
ago.
Back before the world ended.
But, you know, I just think having the option, and obviously, you know, as we all know, venues make their money on bar sales. But that shouldn't be the deciding factor in whether or not accessibility should be. It's not one or the other. You can have both. And, you know, I don't think that it's going to be a thing that people, and if people who are able-bodied want to watch a live stream, why, that they should be able to.
Right.
And, yeah, I just think that, like, the demand for shows is going to be so prominent that that's not going to be the concern of venue owners or the music industry at large.
Some of the many interviews you did for this piece also were people with neurodivergent situations, right? Tell us about that. What did you mean by that, and what are they asking for?
You know, when I talk about neurodivergence, I mean people who are on the autism spectrum or people who have invisible disabilities, you know. Speaking from personal experience, and this doesn't affect my daily life anymore, but when I was a kid, I was diagnosed with epilepsy. And, you know, as a kid, I loved going to shows. And for a while, we didn't know whether or not it was photosensitivity triggered these seizures.
The strobe lights.
Yeah. And, you know, that is a concern. And, you know, it is 3% of people with epilepsy are triggered by these strobe lights, and as we all know from going to live shows, that is a pretty prominent part of a lot of these productions. You know, these are sort of the considerations that people with disabilities have to take with every show that they go to.
Yeah.
You know, they have to, like, do their research for the venue, they have to do their research for the band, you know, like, if you see a, you know, no shots on any of the artists I'm listing in this hypothetical, but if you see, like, say, a Charlie XCX, the light show is going to be way different than if you would see, like, a band like Whitney or, you know, Spun Out or any one of those great Chicago groups.
Right. So what's your checklist of the most important things that venues should be taking care of when it comes to, you know, serving this particular community? What do they need to do? What are the top three things?
The number one thing I would ask venues to do is sort of educate themselves on these issues and talk to their communities, update their websites, make sure that, like, they have a detailed description of what their accessibility requirements are in their facilities and how it's going to go if someone who is disabled buys a ticket to their show.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's, like, that transparency is the number one thing. And I think this is what disability activists have been fighting for years, even before the pandemic. Number two, live streams. You know, if you can't make the costly adjustments that you need to make your venue fully acceptable, have that alternative. And another one is kind of on the touring artists too, because they have these fans. And when we talk about disability, it's 1 in 4 Americans, it's 61 million people. It's a good chunk of a potential fan base. It's a good chunk of the country we live in. You know, it was great to see the piece get some feedback from touring artists and being like, how can we tour more safely?
Mm.
And, you know, having that conversation with the venues and making sure that adding ramps when there needs to be. And also for venues, adding ramps for performers, you know, because I'm talking from the perspective of disabled fans and people in the community. But, you know, disabled musicians have their own set of problems. And, you know, you talk to people and they don't play certain venues because they just can't get to the stage.
Yeah, those narrow winding spiral staircases of three floors from green room to stage. Yeah.
You're making me miss Subterranean right now, Jim.
Oh, I you know, carry your Marshall stack up stairs, man. Thank you, Josh, for joining us on the show and talking about this important issue.
Well, I appreciate that, Jim. Thank you all for reading and having me on.
Josh Terry's full article will be linked on our website, soundopinions.org, where you can also find a transcript of this interview.
Greg, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we are going to dig deep for some buried treasures, some brand new music that we think you should hear.
Fantastic. For more Sound Opinions, listen to our podcast wherever you find such things. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors.
And speaking of sponsors, every week our show reaches hundreds of thousands of curious listeners from around the globe via podcast and on 150 public radio stations nationwide. If you'd like to learn more on how your business or organization can also reach this engaged and educated audience, you can email sponsor at soundopinions.org. That's sponsor at soundopinions.org.
Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne. Our intern is Sol Delgadillo, and our social media consultant is Katie Cott.